Namaste. Last time we spoke about the story of creation and there was also mention about the return journey. So what we need to understand is that this return journey is not just a journey back alone to the alone, but it's a journey where there is a redemption of matter. Matter is being carried up, material nature is being taken up to the divine. And that's how we have to understand the whole process of return of the Divine Mother, the bride of Brahman, back to her home. Now, someone has asked a question which is a very good question, because at least the person has given a thought to it. And the question is that if merger into Parabrahman is the goal, then why the drama of creation at all? And I must say that congratulations to that person, because we keep hearing it from everywhere, moksha, mukti, land, etc., without giving a slightest thought that a divine would create a world and at the end of everything say that, look here, you know, get back to me. That's your goal. So what about the suffering? That's your problem. How? It's your karma. So what about your help? Yeah, time to time I'll come and show you the way. To whom? To a handful of people. And if you take the traditional religions, some of the religions, Semitic religions, that only those who believe in him. So as if the rest of the mankind is totally condemned. And so obviously we have misread the intention. And if we look deep into Sanatana Dharma, into the heart of Hinduism, not as we have understood it today, but as it was in its pristine purity, then we see that it was not at all like that. Today we associated it with moksha, people who, you know, gravitate towards, as sadhus and sannyasis who gravitate to some ashram and start leading a very monastic kind of life. But in ancient times, Sri Aurobindo, in one of his essays, says, this is not the original yoga. The original yoga, karma yoga, he gives two examples of Sri Krishna and Bhishma, who were karma yogins. So what kind of karma yogins they were? They were leading life in the world, engaging in battle, everything which one can imagine. So this idea to start with of moksha is the goal, and moksha itself meaning that I should be freed from the tangle of birth and death and rebirth, is a much later misinterpretation, and as we all know, it has come largely because of the strong Buddhist stamp. Now, for Buddha's age, it was necessary. Buddha didn't contemplate on metaphysical issues. It was not his. He was a man, very strong, tremendous vital, and mighty intellect. But his concern was there is suffering. Let's not get into why it all started, but let's see how we can put an end to it. So for him, that was the question. And in his quest, he found that all suffering is because of desire. And if you eliminate desire, come out of egoism, then you enter a beatific state, the state of inner silence, nirvana, and then you can eventually pass beyond this entire zone, which is, you know, the troubled, vexed life of man. So it was all right for him, but subsequently, maybe because of the kind of, on one side, there was a slow degeneration of the original Vedic Dharma. It degenerated into Karmakand. People were engaged in that. The subtlety, the vastness was gradually getting crystallized into something more narrow, dogmatic, more ritualistic. So people started opting out for something which was more wide in a certain sense. It was required at that age. And then it became, the final seal was put by Shankaracharya. Though he tried to actually counter Buddhism, because Buddhism is supposed to be a non-Vedic religion. So he wanted to re-establish the Vedas, but he ended up saying that instead of using the word Nirvana, he used the word One. But what about nature? Again, he left it unexplained. It was not necessary, because once you bring in the concept of Maya, the way it has been conceived, then there is nothing to explain, because it is an illusion. It's like you're watching a movie and somebody says, you know, it's a horror movie. Fine, switch it off. Who is trying to explain now when Maya itself is an illusion maker and itself an illusion? Then the whole question ceases. It becomes redundant. So what we have to do? Step out of this entire, you know, illusory zone. It's something like you enter into a, you know, there are those horror places. I remember one in Chennai, and though I don't like such places. I just casually wandered in, some people were there, and suddenly, you know, the eerie music and all that. So I said, why you want to enter into it? Step out. So it's a choice you make, because it's, you don't want to experience this kind of horror and suffering for no reason. And then subsequently, because then it became, this became the predominant impulse rather than trying to understand. So the under, then eventually there was a division. There is the one consciousness, and this entire field is an illusion in which for some reason the soul has stepped in, and now its only choice for it is to come out. So, but this is a complete misreading of the original intention. So Sri Aurobindo, in one of his essays, describes moksha. Moksha is freedom. So one of the things that the our great forefathers were looking for is freedom. And if I look at it that way, I find it very contemporary, because we all want freedom. Who doesn't want freedom? But this freedom that they were looking for is that from the field of ignorance. So when they started looking at the entire apparatus of nature, creation, they found that the soul passes through these three stages in its transition through nature. We'll come to this play a little later. So first stage is when the soul is completely submerged with by nature. It has no independent thought, nothing it can decide. So very often people ask, oh, the soul chooses because, you know, mother has said so. There is a certain context behind it. When Sri Aurobindo was asked that, are human beings, is there really a free will? He says, if you take the Gita, then 90% of the time there is no such thing as a free will. Yantra Rudini Maya. So he gives this example as a fly on the wheel. There is an illusion of free will. And as long as you have the illusion, act as if there is a free will, because there's a choice given to you. But one is completely submerged in darkness. Now what about then? One will remain? No, there is an evolutionary impetus. Because there is the divine within creation, therefore nobody can remain forever in that state. So out of that completely dark state, even nourished by that scrap and, you know, like a seed inside the plant, inside the soil, there is an impulsion to come up. So in Vedanta, there is a whole idea of evolution which goes unnoticed. Though originally, there is the idea of evolution of the soul. Later on, it also speaks about evolution of the form, which is there in the story of Dashavatar. But the evolution of the soul from a state where it is completely submerged under nature and acts completely as if it was a slave, to a state where it becomes a witness of nature, to a state where it becomes a master of nature. So that is regarded as a freedom. Freedom is that I am no more a slave to nature, but I am its master. It doesn't mean I discard nature. It means that I ride over it. I choose. Now I choose what kind of energy, force must be put out for the sake of the play. So instead of being this other aspect. So the first thing that they all tried was freedom or self-mastery. And this is the first step. And this is what is meant by Swami. I am a master of myself. This is the first freedom. Then the second freedom is freedom from ignorance. What it means is that I do not know who I am. Now we take it for granted that, of course we know, and everybody has their identity cards and everybody has their, you know, visiting cards. But this is precisely a false identity. So what is the true identity? If we go back to the roots, it is, he am I. I am Brahman. Now this is too powerful a statement for an average human being completely drowned in ignorance. How can I be God? Now, yeah, of course, we are not God in, if we start looking, God is everywhere in everything. But I have the same basic essence within me, and I can arrive at the fullness of the God experience and be as a God upon earth, as the divine consciousness upon earth. So I am the same Brahman. It just because of ignorance of identifying with nature, I think I am this, I am that, and so what is its practical import? Tremendous practical import. First, there is a complete freedom from all kinds of fears. That's why one of the qualities of Brahman is that there is no fear. Nirbhayo. That's how even the Sikh religion would call it. Why there is freedom from fear? Because you know you are the immutable one. Freedom of death, freedom of anything. So anything that is changing, you are not that. You are the unchangeable eternal. So that's how you see one word, or two, three words to Sri Krishna, gave him the realization. It was, Sri Aurobindo says that from Rishi Ghora, and it made him completely become aware. He didn't, of course, it was an excuse, the general excuse that you need to go to a master who will give you a realization. So what did Rishi Ghor tell him? He told him that you are Achyutam. You are, you cannot fall. You are imperishable. So, and you are the prana of prana. You are the mahaprana. So all prana is at your feet. Now the moment he remembered it, he said it's like a memory. So many times this awakening is also called as memory. You recover your hid self. Oh, I am that. I am not this. Now this does not mean withdrawing. It means a tremendous vantage point. Imagine a person who is completely aware that he is imperishable, immutable. Death cannot slay him. Destruction, change. He is superior to all kinds of change. Let's take a couple of examples. One example of such a person, because you know this idea of a moksha is a very much later idea in the sense that I will not come back to earth. There is a poem of Sri Aurobindo which is called Immortal Love. Now if you read through this sonnet, so it gives a clue to what love can become if you discover this immortal self within you. So he describes it in this way that look, if I loved you for your charming face and your hairs and all this, your sweet voice, after a while this will change. So my love is going to fade away. If I loved you for the sweetness of your voice, for your qualities and attributes, maybe I'll go on till time might pursue, might reach. Still, you can't say because things can change, personality can change, you know, and some people do develop states where you completely, all these qualities go away. But finally he says, but I have loved you for myself indeed. Change I exceed and am for time prepared. So myself with myself I have snared. Now look at it, the practical import of this. Practical import is that we can have a relationship with the world, with others based on the ego, and this relationship eventually is either a divisive, it will lead to catastrophe, or it will lead to a kind of mutual adjustment, accommodation, very neat surface that, you know, I mean, I can say this as a psychiatrist, please don't be horrified, but this is the world in which we human beings dwell. This is a very nice surface, facade, in which everybody is very good, but there is the backyard where all kinds of things are taking place, which is less said the better. Now this is why, because one has not really learned to relate with this world. So this vantage point that we discover the imperishable one, and when we start connecting with this aspect of everyone, because what we have discovered in ourselves, that only we can discover in others, then only. So people often say unconditional love, love without expectations. How can we do it as long as I am a slave of nature? Nature will push me. Even if I, in a very nice intellectual moment, say that, look, you know, I want to love in a way that there is no expectation. Nature will say, okay, you have said it. Okay, now you stay quiet. So after some time, nature will push you. Rajasic nature. You see what you have done and what the other person has done? No, no, I am not supposed to think like this. Mind will tell you. The vital will say, are you sure? Don't get fooled. She is fooling you, he is fooling you. Now what is happening here? Life is becoming miserable. So if we look at it like this way, we realize that Sanatana Dharma was a way to make life beautiful. Where is this strain within it to run away? It's like instead of sad strains of music mixed with some happy strains, it wants joy in creation, but the true joy, which cannot come as long as we are living in the divisive framework of the ego. This was one goal, self-mastery, and then extending it, freedom from ignorance, knowing who I am, not only who I am. There are people who get into delusion, you know, how to know a delusion from the real. So there is somebody who came to me for treatment. So, you know, nicely he has come, everything. So I asked him, you know, I knew what the whole thing was, so... Anyways, he tells me after some time, you know, you can do, give me whatever treatment you want. I said, I mean, little more about yourself. He said, I am supreme. So I have a counter question. If you are supreme, who am I? You're a doctor sitting there. So then you know that, you know, somebody who has discovered the divine element within you will know the divine element inside you. See, when somebody asks the Divine Mother, you know, this is a very simple test. You want to really test somebody has discovered or not. when Divine Mother was asked, he will know the differences. It's not that he will be blind to, that's not equanimity. He'll know where darkness is acting, this, that. But fundamental error. So when Mother was asked, who am I? So Mother said, the divine under many disguises. At another place, she says something similar, that it's you have to just discover what I know already. That's what Sri Krishna tells to Arjuna. You have forgotten, but I remember it. So this memory, this awakening has a tremendous, profound effect in our dealing with everyday life. That's what people don't understand about Sanatana Dharma, why people are praying to everything. Why not? Everything is God. This is the great tonic. Only the difference is some human beings, in humanity we can realize God, whereas in the lesser beings, because we are so submerged in nature, that trying that experiment will be catastrophic. You have to break free from a dark coat. And even in human beings, not all are ready for this realization. Because why? Because it can shatter all measures. That is the other part. That's why there is a graduality, which was also recognized. Okay, fine, so I am God, let me start with this. So I remember another person who actually had a true experience. Now see, sometimes they are luminously mad. So what was happening with him, he was just embracing everybody. So people brought him and said, I said, why are you doing this? He said, no, because everything is God. I said, you are saying it or you feel it? He said, I feel it. I said, what about, he was embracing the tree, the pillar, actually he was doing it. I said, okay, now I'll tell you one thing. I am also God. Yes, you are also God. I said, then as a God, listen to me, don't embrace. Live with this consciousness is fine. Because police will catch you. The story of Mahavat Brahman. I said, police will catch you. They won't understand. You will be in deep trouble. He understood that. Stopped it. I am completely a person who is, but he. It was so overwhelming an experience that he is unable to contain. So there are all kinds of things, nature, soul. So they understood the entire, they were seekers of knowledge. If you really look at it, where this tendency has come, life is full of suffering. They were seekers. Seekers of knowledge. They called it Vidya, that true knowledge. And they were not satisfied with halfway homes. So if you look at it another way, what were they really searching for truth? Not the truth as I understand. My truth is a legal truth. This patta is in my name. Somebody else has occupied it. Now you say that satyameva jayate nanritam. But I don't see it. My house has been taken by somebody else. Now, you know, if you tell a person, it can go on to anything. So this truth was not the ever-changing truth. Truth of appearances is part of nature. We need to know that. Not that we don't need to know that. That's why we have the entire Sankhya system, which has been accepted by Sri Krishna, by Sri Aurobindo, that there is an ever-changing nature. And we must understand the entire play of forces. But right now, because we are focusing on what was the goal. So this is one part. We need to understand nature. But most importantly, what is truth? Truth is that last bedrock from where everything is emerging. There is nothing which you can go beyond. It's ever unchanging. Whatever may happen, even if there is entire pralaya, destruction, this will remain. The entire creation may collapse, but this will remain. So they were in search of that truth, not our temporary truths, which, you know, change by the moment. And when we again base our life on that truth, then life becomes wonderful. So this was to them truth. What did they discover about truth? Not the way we understand bare truth. Harsh truth. That's the asura's truth. It's like for every divine quality, there is an asuric imitation of it. For instance, there is a law of truth. Satya dharmaye. What is the law of truth? Law of truth is never a rigid dogma. It is an infinitely plastic. Each moment it recreates itself. That's how the mother says, that each moment the universe is recreated. Which means if you remember it, you will never lose hope. Why? Because till the last minute, you have a breath, right? Universe can change. Imagine the kind of profundity. This is the law of truth. Not like you are condemned forever to hell. Nothing like that. Whereas in death, the imitation, the same law of truth becomes the law of darkness. Yama. What is Yamaraj's law? Doesn't matter. I have been given these orders. Whether you are Markandeya, Savitri, whoever, I am going to obey harshly. That's precisely what Savitri, Markandeya, these stories are, that no, there is a greater law, and it's a law of compassion, a law of love, a law of benevolence. It's not this harsh truth. So what is that truth? They said truth is, mother puts it, supreme harmony. But in the Vedas, if we go, they said this truth is supreme delight. Raso vesa. This is the origin of creation. See, desire element is later in Buddhism. That too, I have a feeling this has been misunderstood. When it is said, it's a question of how we use the word desire. If you see the Nasadiya Sutra, the word is sometimes kama. So, you know, and even in Upanishad it will come. Tamatma sthamik, yenupashyanti dhira. And there you see, eko bahu naam yo kama. Now, this is the word kama. Now, this kama, seizing the one, is not this kama as we experience. It's the same thing, like we use the word love. Is it the same thing as when we speak about divine love? Not at all. We use the same word. It's a state of consciousness. It is the will that has seized. And that will is for what? It's for ananda. That is the original impulsion. So now, why are we not able to discover this ananda? Not because life is full of suffering. It's because we don't know how to convert all this into the equivalent of ananda. Why we are not able to do it? Because we become very narrow. Again, we go back to the same problem. Egoism, desire, everything I want is what will give me pleasure, happiness. So in Indian thought, Sanatana Dharma, pleasure was never a goal. It was there as a side dish. You can have it. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. You can have it as a side dish. But that also a desire which is consistent with dharma. So if it is, and dharma here is not a moral law. For everything there is a dharma. So if you follow that dharma, it is fine. But if you don't have the dharma behind it, and you know, for every stage of evolution there is a dharma. Let's say, for example, if there is an actual fight going on between two wrestlers. So what is the dharma? According to dharma, who is going to win? Now, in our usual moralistic attitude, we'll say somebody who has filed all his taxes in time. No, that's not the dharma of wrestling. Who will win the wrestling match is the person who has given to his body, muscles, vital force, enough training. The dharma of a fight is that. You can't claim victory just because you have been a good guy. You may be a good guy in another field. There you will get your own, reap your own reward. See how much it's clear in that. So if you want to wrestle, you prepare yourself. Then only you can have a fight. That's why in the Mahabharata, what does Shri Krishna tell Arjuna when, you know, during the Vanvas? He says, don't think that you are the best archer in the world. Go get Divyastra. Because you are going to face a battle. And in a battle, the god of battle is not going to touch upon you are an honest person. Actually, you didn't deserve. Shakuni did the wrong thing. None of these will be evaluated. Because that time, the god of battle is there. He will see whether you are really, really a master in what you are doing or not. So become a master. So this way, when we understand then life towards mastery of everything. And when we look at life like that, then we see that there is delight in everything. There is a delight in each effort. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be successful. It's because we have put that little conditioning. There is a joy in each experience of the soul. Sri Aurobindo in Savitri goes on to say there is a bliss in even sin, and it stares at all the scriptures. You see, all the scriptures will tell you that, you know, don't do this sin because you'll be punished. And surprisingly, the places where the concept of sin is very strong, punishment is very strong, most indulgence you will find there. It finds its root. Sin grows on forbidden soil, precisely because it's forbidden. Now, the moment you say forbidden, there is a new kind of experience to enter a territory which you have written forbidden. It's a human nature. So, bliss in each experience, but bliss in each experience is very different from bliss in its purity. So this is the new. So at each level there is a certain joy appropriate to the dharma of that level. But you should not confuse it and think this is the ultimate joy. And also it should not be a perversion and degradation. Then it becomes not consistent with dharma. It's a very cryptic phrase in the Gita that a desire which is consistent with dharma, I permit, this also comes from me, if you look at it. So what is consistent with dharma? It is not like I have earned honest earning, therefore I can spend any amount of money and live in, what is that building? Attila or whatever. La Attila. That's not dharma. Dharma is in you, that unfolding. Say a Kshatriya, he wants to conquer a kingdom, a foe who has attacked him. He is well within his right to conquer the kingdom and take it as his own. Rajyam Samriddham. This is dharma. If a Brahmin were to do it, it is adharma. Because for a Brahmin, there are another domain to conquer, which is domains of knowledge. So again, we had this concept of Swadharma and, you know, the general progression of man. So it was a very fascinating system where we knew that bliss is in everything, but bliss in its original purity, like the Ganges in its pristine purity, and the experience of Ganges had become sullied. Still, it has the same effect. So there were those who were happy with this. There was never a moral doctrine. You are happy with this, fine, be happy. But if you want the purer one, you have to renounce. This renunciation was not for out of a, oh my God, I have to renounce life. It was always for a greater life. Take for example that, you know, people take a dip in Haridwar and they feel so blessed. Well, fine. But some people say that I want to see that origin. I want to go to Gomukh. Not even Gangotri, Gomukh. Then what we have to do? We can't stay in Haridwar and be at the same time in Gomukh. So Haridwar is wonderful. But you have to leave Haridwar, go further. You go to Gangotri. You want still further? Go to Gomukh. You want still further? Meditate upon Shiva. You want to go still further? Shivaji ke tu jata mein hai. Then you meditate upon Narayana, the Lord Vishnu. Discover within his heart the origin of the Ganges. Experience that feelings which arose within his heart, which Brahmaji keeps as, oh, I bypassed Brahmaji, sorry. So Brahmaji is Kamandalu, then Vishnuji is heart. Poor Brahmaji is always bypassed, you know. It is very interesting. Have you noticed that there are hardly any temples dedicated to Brahmaji? That's another story. But it's like the joking part of it is you didn't do a very good job. But that's not the story. The story is very different, very amazing story. It's again related to creation. But the interesting part is bliss is the goal. Just imagine what a powerful statement it is. Very different from, you know, life is full of suffering, let me get out. Life is full of suffering, discover the original bliss. Live blissfully. Because we are children of bliss, we are children of immortality. Life is full of death, discover the immortal element. Life is full of unconsciousness, discover the supreme consciousness. You feel weak and helpless and powerless, discover the absolute power. This was the quest, the Satchidanand. And then lead life. So where did this moksha come from? Well, there is an element of, very small element of truth in it, that those who after great labor reach that point, it's like you're too exhausted. Now I want to enter into, I don't want to get back into creation. So that is called laya. The right term for it is laya. They merge into the absolute and it was allowed. Why not? Somebody who has reached that point has the right to say, ki, I don't want to, you know, come back and start, you know, once again lead a life. But there is another goal which was much more fascinating, which is the larger goal that Sanatana Dharma has put before mankind. And that goal is the goal of Jivan Mukta. You can be inwardly free and yet be in the world. It's like saying, be in the world, but not of the world. So, we read a little passage on that from Sri Aurobindo before we go to the final. So, we have one goal is the laya, which is merger. And it's meant for certain souls who have probably reached but are not ready for the final plunge. But there's another goal, which was the larger will in creation of Jivan Mukta. So there is a whole line of Bhishma, Shri Krishna, King Janak, many such examples. We are all examples of Jivan Mukta, which we have forgotten today. So we have become very mokshvadi, and this kind of vairagya, life is full of pain. It doesn't help. By just simply saying life is full of pain, I want moksha, one doesn't get moksha. It's a very difficult labor. It's not an easy labor. There is nobody waiting out there that, okay, you belong to this religion, okay, granted moksha. you will be exacted. You know, like anything, like, you know, Shiva was who gives moksha. Shiva is known for moksha. Shri Krishna for the Leela. If you go to Shri Krishna and say moksha, he'll say, oh, you want moksha? Okay, he will do a Vaishnavi Maya and say, okay, show me how you will get out of it. And you'll be so much caught in it, you won't know where is the left, right, up and below. Because Vaishnavi Maya, you can break free from Asuric Maya by the Devas. How are you going to break free from Vaishnavi Maya except when you are ready for it? Whereas if you go to Shiva, so what you have to do, you go and ask moksha, he'll say, okay, meet me in Shamshan. So you go to Shamshan, what? No, no, this is not the Shamshan. Completely get free from all kinds of egoism. You can't say like I am egoless free, then sore because the dinner was not ready. You have to be completely free from all kinds of egoism. So this idea that because life is suffering, therefore let me have moksha and, you know, I go to some place and start practicing some meditation, this all come later on because of this sense of pain, suffering. Maybe also the invasions may have had something to contribute. But that's not the goal that Sanatana Dharma ever had. In fact, if lay is the ultimate goal, it is true. It makes a mockery of the whole origin. The creation is meant so that each element, each unit of it, each soul within it can become even as the God. And then take delight in creation, the share of the ras and the ecstasy after. You know, Shivindu's poem Ahana. This is what creation is meant for. So I'll read something on the Jivan Mukta. So this is again from Ishavasya Upanishad, which in the new volume, it's on page 117, collected works of Sri Aurobindo. So there is a question which is asked about prarabdha karma and these karmas, because what is that Jivan Mukta state? There is a certain, what is karma? Certain energies we have let loose into certain grooves of habit. So they, by the past momentum, they continue. They'll become weaker and weaker and weaker, and you'll become stronger and stronger and stronger. But those energies will still continue by the fact that you have let them off. They will run their course and dry off. But inwardly, you'll be free. Still, they are not going to just... So it's a paradox. How are you free when these old things are still following you? So here the disciple asks this question. Also, there is a description that what this person is, why does he act? So he acts, the Gita gives it very beautifully. Even if he is mukta, his body and mind are not free from karma until his body is dropped off. But go on under the impulse of prarabdha. Prarabdha is, there are three types of karma as we know in Indian thought. One is Sanchit karma, which is the big store, Amazon. Prarabdha is what you draw from the Amazon for this life. Utkat is, it will keep waiting for you at the right moment and suddenly appear. You can't get rid of it. So prarabdha, you can modify this as per the Indian thought. So Sri Aurobindo is using that term. Until the prarabdha and its fruits are complete, nay, even the greatest yogi by his mere bodily presence in the phenomenal world is pouring out a stream of spiritual force on all sides. And this action, though it does not bind him, has a stupendous influence on others. The yogin is not afraid of life. In fact, he pours himself out on life with tremendous energy and force and vigor. All the great yogins, if you really go back and look and how they have changed life, they may not call themselves yogin. That's all right. That's better actually, because I am yogi, so and so is like, you know, too, what shall I say, superfluous. you have to be, not pretend to be something. So this is his action. And he is sarva bhuta hite rata. So one of the signs of a person who is jivan mukta is he never acts for any selfish ends. It doesn't interest, doesn't engage. You may try whatever it be, but it will never come that, you know, it's for himself, that advantage, benefit, all those selfish things which normally, ordinarily, as human beings, we are prone to. That how this will benefit me, how this I will gain. Mother goes on to say that if one is a Jivan Mukta, if he comes back, he will come to do God's work in the world. He will come with a mission that this is my work, and he will be conscious of the mission and do God's work. But certain things will be there as part of nature till the nature is transformed. So he is sarvabhuthite rata. Though he wills it not. Very beautiful. It's not that he is wanting even that. Oh, I want to help humanity. I want to be an instrument of God. All that is gone. But the very fact of his existence becomes a radiating influence upon all. He too, with regard to his body, is avashya and must let the gunas of prakriti work. So he is God within, but the material nature is still not transformed. It will be subject to the gunas. And that's where we see Sri Aurobindo makes an entry into that the final victory can only be if you want to lead a divine life. Jivan Mukta is not enough. One has to transform nature. But that's a new goal which Sri Aurobindo has put before mankind. This goal has been glimpsed in, you know, when the Vedic Rishi aspired at least for their intellect to become Dhimati, and you know, it must be illumined, the rays of intuition. So they were aspiring for it. Heaven on earth, like Ramaraj, all these conceptions, behind it is the possibility that there will be an ideal state, individually and collectively. But it is not yet. Since this is so, let every man who wishes to throw his kartavya karma behind him see that he is not merely postponing the completion of his prarabdha to a future life and thereby condemning himself to the rebirth he wishes to avoid. Very beautiful thing. So if those people say, okay, I am not going to, you know, work further because it will bind me. He is addressing the Shankara doctrine that when you reach this point, you need not. But prarabdha karma is chasing you. You don't want to complete your evolution in this life. Okay, fine. It will sit in the Amazon store. You come next life, it will come to you. Unasked for parcel. Then you will say, but I didn't order for it. So you will say, but you ordered for it. Show me my name. Name is past life name. You don't recognize it, but it will come. So this is where he is revealing to us that you cannot avoid it. So go through it. So people would want to be away from kartavyam karma, want to withdraw from life, don't want to act, don't want to do what they are meant to do. Here kartavyam karma is not duty, but what you are meant to do, you know, in relation to Arjuna to fight. So you must engage with it because that's how you will complete that cycle. So the student is asking, but how can this be that the Jivan Mukta is still bound by his past deeds? Does not Mukti burn up one's past deeds as in a fire? For how can one be at the same time free and yet bound? Good question. So the Guru answers, Sri Aurobindo. Mukti prevents one's future deeds from creating bondage. But what of the past deeds which have already created bondage? The Jivan Mukta is not indeed bound, for he is one with God, and God is the master of his prakriti, not its slave. But the prakriti attached to this Jivan Mukta has created causes while in the illusion of bondage and must be allowed to work out its effects. Otherwise, the chain of causation is snapped and the whole economy of nature is disturbed and thrown into chaos. This is precisely one of the arguments or the logic which the Supreme Divine gives to Savitri. He says that you want men to be as gods, which means you are free from karma. Even in volume 3, the mother says that what is this new birth? So she says that it means that supramental realization, you will be free from karma. Now the problem with that is that what about that past thing which has continued till now? Who will bear its burden? You will leave it for earth. It is there as an energy. It has to go somewhere. Somewhere it will find release. So you better clean your own house rather than, you know, let it, if at all that was possible. But here he says, no, it won't, because you have to go through that chain, clean your own house, and then yes. And that's what he says, that if you all men were God suddenly, then this chain will be disturbed, because it's not just a simple chain. Here in this cause and effect chain, everybody is tied to everybody else. So you can't just say it's my karma as if you are independent, cut off from everyone else. So if you try it, it won't. So that's why he says the world will be thrown into chaos. In order to maintain the worlds, therefore, the Jivan Mukta remains working, and uses a very beautiful term, like a prisoner on parole. You're not in prison. You're free. But there is something where, you know, okay, you're supposed to be there, but you are outside. So prisoner on parole. Not bound indeed by others, but detained by himself until the previous period previously appointed for his captivity shall have elapsed. So the Jivan Mukta doesn't seek that, you know, when will I be free. He knows that when the time comes, inwardly he is free. The Divine Mother will free him. You see, the story of Swami Vivekananda is very interesting. Swami Vivekananda, he had this urge, merge. So one day Sri Ramakrishna tells him, you know, I know you can get mukti anytime, but I have locked the doors, handed over the key to Divine Mother, told her, don't give it, otherwise he'll not do the work he is meant to do. Another place he predicted, the day he knows who he is, he will not be able to stay on earth. Third time when Sister Nivedita asks Ma Sharda, I don't understand this great yogi. He is so wide, so vast when he talks about Brahman. But tell him a word against India. He is up in sleeves to give a boxing. What happens to him? He flies into a rage. So she says, you don't understand this. Deliberately, the world mother has put a little veil on him. Otherwise, this fellow will not stay. He has to do a work. He will just go away. So she holds him back by this means. So these are the ways of the Lord. So in idea, and it's true that when he discovers, he didn't stop. He just went away, leaving everything. That last letter where he says, all my work was ambition. If you read his last letter, which is so much misunderstood, see, he writes that all that I did in my life, I realized it was ambition. And yet, who made him use that ambition? None else but the Divine Mother. Because she uses both knowledge and ignorance. Had he known, he would not have done what he did, which was needed for the world. So that's how one continues to be. When the time comes, when the Divine Mother wants, she will do whatever is needed. Of course, as I said, now there is a new possibility which we find only vague hints, and that possibility, countless stories of Dadichi I was referring, where even the physical can be transformed. This possibility has been foreseen, and now this new door has opened where right up to most material aspects of nature and outer nature can be transformed, and that is the new goal added to Sanatana Dharma. It has been glimpsed far off. And it is implicit. If creation is divine in origin, if there is the divine in every particle of creation, it is bound to become. It can't be just a hopeless thing that, you know, at the end, go back and merge. It is implicit in the very thought, the metaphysical system and the philosophy and the vision. But it was never brought out with full force and vigor because the time had not come. So then he asks a little more about it, that will then the Jivan Mukta actually wish to live 100 years? Can one who is mukt have a desire? Because the Shruti says, Kurvan nevihe karmani jijivishe chatang sama. So the Guru says, the Jivan Mukta will be perfectly ready to live 100 years or more if needs be. But this recommendation is given not to the Jivan Mukta or to any particular class of person, but generally. So he makes a distinction that you must live the fullness of life. Where is the ring of hopelessness, pessimism, this merger back into Parabrahman? Parabrahman is not pleased. In fact, he will say, what, you came back? Yes, sir, see, I am the first to come back. He will say, if he could say, he'll say, fool, you think I started this whole thing so that you come back and tell me I got a first prize? It's the last prize. So what I have to do? He'll say, I have a paradoxical rule. What is that paradoxical rule? They who come last are the first. Because they've chosen to live 1,000 lives, but engaged in bringing that light to each particle of dust. That's what Shobhinda says in Savitri. No? Because you have refused the nameless calm, because you have accepted my yoke in time, therefore I lay upon you this. Because that's what Savitri says, that I don't mind. 1,000 lives, that's what we see in the Bhagavat. That may I have 1,000 births to serve thee. So this is the great goal. You should desire to live your allotted term of life, because you in the body are the Brahman who by the force of his own Shakti is playing for himself, by himself, this Leela of creation, preservation and destruction. So in each of us, the Brahman and Maya, the Ishwara and Shakti are there, limited as Purusha and Prakriti. Now Purusha can realize Brahman and Ishwara. What about Prakriti? She must also realize that she is also Shakti. So ideally within us, there should be the play of Brahman and his Shakti. Brahman is Isha, the Lord, creator and destroyer, and you also are Isha, creator and destroyer. Only for your own amusement, to use a violent metaphor, you have imagined yourself limited by a particular body for the purposes of the play. Just as an actor imagines himself to be Dushyant or Rama or Ravana, and often the actor loses himself in the part and really feels himself to be what he is playing, forgetting that he is really not Dushyant or Rama, but that Devadatt who plays 100 parts besides. Still, when he shakes off this illusion and remembers that he is Devadatt, he does not therefore walk off from the stage and by refusing to act, break up the play, but goes on playing his best till the proper time for the curtain to fall. So it's not like when an actor is doing a play and has completely forgotten, suddenly says, oh, but you know what? I am so and so. He doesn't walk off the stage and say, okay, done, enough. He continues to play, but now he is playing with a full awareness of who he is. And so we should all do, whether as householder or sannyasi, as jivan mukta or a mumukshu, remembering always that the object of this sansara is creation, and that it is our business, so long as we are in the body, to create. The only difference is this, that so long as we forget ourselves, we create like servants under the compulsion of our prakriti or nature, and are, as it were, slaves and bound by her actions, which we imagine to be ours. So we don't create, we recreate. Recreation, no? We don't create, but the closer you get to the original consciousness, the more you will have the authentic original creation. But nevertheless, create. But when we know the self and experience our true self, then we are masters of our prakriti and not bound by her creations. Our soul becomes the sakshi, the silent spectator. Then Rama is not really killing Ravana, nor Ravana being killed. For indeed Ravana lives as much after the supposed death as before. So are we, neither actor nor spectator, but the self only. And all we see only visions of the self. So now what happens with this is some people start, you know, questioning that, okay, then all this is fine, moksha and swamitva and all this. Is there any place for moral living? So, well, there is. So because not moral the way it is understood. Moral living in the Semitic concept is you have a column, right or wrong. There is nothing like gray. You know, black to white moves through shades of grey. That's how evolution is. But nevertheless, the whole thing is about, it's not called morality, but you prepare for that self-mastery so you have a certain kind of life. Now this is important because there are people, for example, people want to practice yoga of transformation. It's a wonderful thing. But you can't practice the yoga of transformation if you are slave to your impulses. I mean, it's just not possible. You have to go through it. It doesn't matter where you start from. You can be a candidate, but there is the step. What mother can do is she will make you go rapidly. But you can't say that I can remain a very tamasic man and one day I will have the illumination of the golden light. More likely than not, it will be a hallucination. But if you really go through the steps and stages of evolution, then we describe that the soul, when it is subject to nature, must arrive at what is called as a high sattvic nature, or at least rajo-sattvic turn, which is the deva nature which Sri Krishna speaks of. It is only then and only then, that one becomes candidate for moksha, jivan mukti, or whatever higher thing one wants to do. But it is not, see, the attitude is very different. In a Semitic religion, most boring classes used to be in the convent school where moral science classes. Everybody knows that, you know. So, but moral science classes was do not do this, do this, do a lot of do's, don'ts. You don't remember by the time you come out, you know, what you have to do, what you don't do. But for what? Look at the attitude is so horrible. The attitude is if you do the right thing, stick the right box, there is God sitting out there who will say, now here, stick the right box. He is my favorite one. There is nothing like that. It's for your own good. If you want to evolve, it's an evolutionary journey. It's not about good or bad. It's about doing things. What is sattva? It's a more illumined state than rajas. Same action. It's not about this or that. It is about this and that. But the action changes. So that's why the Gita makes it so beautiful. You may give dana in a tamasic state, meaning thereby I have a little extra money and I keep. I remember a friend of mine who married 5 times and fifth time he comes to me and gives a nice long advertisement in newspaper, running into almost rich man. So he says, just see how is it. I said, this model doesn't exist. Then after 10 days he says, my advertisement has worked. I'm going to get married. So be the witness. I said, please don't. Highly brilliant man. All the, you know, many big things in India, software done by him. He said, you know, please be the witness. I said, please, why do you want me to be a party to a sin which I know it is not going to last? No, no, you be the witness. So I went as a witness. 15 days it lasted. So it's, you know, the whole thing. Now, this is a journey. It's not about right or wrong or sin or this thing. Now, the beauty is that you can do the same action in a state of tamas, dana. So he was like this. One day he comes and says, you know, I was going on the road. So I decided, because when he broke up from the marriage, then after 15 days. So what he did was, he said all the things which I shared with her, I'm going to give away. So he was telling me his experience. I took all the bedroll and everything in my car. So I was going. So the first man I saw on the road, like Karna, I gave away everything. I said, so you passed on your burden to somebody else now. At least you should have given consideration whom to give. He said, no, I just saw the first person and I just gave. Now this is tamasic. It creates a delusion inside. You think you are giving, but it's a state of, what does tamasic dan do? It gives delusion to yourself and to the one who receives it. And then rajasic, same thing again, you are giving, but you are doing it with the idea that I am the giver. So you want to look good. You want people to know that, you know, how much I have given. And this, that, and 100 things. You know, people, when Golkund was being made and somebody said, I'll give so much money, but I want my name to be put as a plaque. The most horrible thing you find in temples is, you know, benches also. By late, sometimes you wonder. I saw one place donated by late Janki Devi. So I asked, who is this Janki Devi? He says, you know, somebody's nani. I say, oh God, I know so many Janki Devis. What does it matter? Poor lady, she has gone, assumed another name. Why you want to, you know, do that? It's actually very horrifying, because it will become dirty and all this. So mother said something very interesting. He says, okay, you tell him to give the money, we'll put his name on a plaque on the floor. People will walk over it. Oh, is it? No, no, no. So this is rajas. You do the same thing, but you are doing it with ostentatiousness. But rajas again can be a more towards tamas, asuric. That's why, you know, King Bali, oh, he was a great generous man, yes. But this generosity was not inspired by a sattvic ideal. And which was evident in, like, you know, I have promised, so I'll give. This was the last test for Bali. And his guru cautioned him. No, I have promised, so I must give. It looks very high, but it speaks, where is Sri Krishna? I have promised I'll never lift arms. Bhishma compels him to lift arms. He says, I am bound to, you know, because this promise is overridden by something much greater. Right now, dharma is at stake. If Arjuna dies, the very whole war becomes meaningless. So, yes, you can tell me I broke my promise. I am ready to accept the verdict by history that, oh, he broke his promise. But to me, this is a greater. So, there is a greater and greater truth beyond this. And then the sattvic is whenever you give the same thing, but with considerations of time, place, and person. You don't just give it just because anybody, but you give in, take into consideration time, place, person. And then, of course, the spiritual gift is where you are not the giver. You are only when you are impelled by the divine within that you let it go. And you know ki you were never a giver. You are a trustee. It has come to you. It has to go. But you have to be impelled by something within, by the divine will. So this is the whole process. It was not about action. So that's why they didn't put it in a bracket, but because they wanted to understand, us to understand that action evolves. The state of consciousness is important. Attitude is important. Even one may go to God, one may live in an ashram, but the attitude may be very different. That I am living now, I am on prosperity list. So henceforth I'll be may, you know, it will be ensured for me that not only my food and everything is free, but also my transformation will be given effortlessly. It doesn't work like that. Nowhere Shurbindu has said that. He has constantly said that your surrender has to be spontaneous, genuine, glad, sincere, all the words attached to that. It cannot be that just because I am, you know, therefore. So the whole thing was they wanted to make, otherwise it becomes a religion, no? Same religion that if you are stamped by, baptized into Christianity, therefore you are a liberated being. It doesn't work like that. No God will ever. Though Christ said, I am the path and I am the way, but he never said that all generations, I have once for all purged all the sins. It doesn't work like that. So Krishna also said, Aham tva sarva pape bhyo mokshisami masucha. Doesn't mean that I'll say, oh Krishna, and therefore I start doing anything and everything and I believe that he is going to, you know, liberate me. So they showed the gradual evolution of human consciousness towards that point. They knew the challenges and real difficulties of human beings. From tamas you can't go to sattva, so you have to go through different layers of rajas, then slowly into sattva, then when you are in sattva, then you can go further. So there is the place for nobility, for, you know, that's sattva is what? It's noble living. It's living by the highest yardstick and standards of your age and your time. That much is within our, you know, we are supposed to do at least that. And then when we are ready, we go further. So these are the goals. As I said, it is not at all, it's a misconception that we have to go back and become one with Brahman and feel very happy about it. We may feel happy, but Brahman will not be happy for sure. But for Brahman, it will make no difference. Countless souls come. He has several times, pralaya has taken place and everything has come. But the will for manifestation is not laya, but manifestation, creation. That's why he says. So what kind of creation? Divine creation. What is the sign of divine creation? It is based on truth and oneness. And what is its quality? Its quality is anandamaya, it is bliss. So till we have found that point where all creation is an expression of the truth within, so dharma, or the greater truth, Sanatana Dharma, which is, you know, at the root of everything, we have to, the journey must go on. When we have found it, do we cease? No. Then we create beautifully, powerfully, mightily, blissfully. Then we truly create. Then life begins. Then joy begins. Why should one want to withdraw after that? So the goal is to create as the divine has created, to be his partners, co-sharers. But create what? Not egoistically, selfishly, for our little things. But create for Lok Sangrahart, for the march of mankind. Create so that there is delight, oneness, harmony, beauty, light, truth expresses itself more and more in the world. And then we see that final goal that Shurbindu says, because the original impulse is manifestation. And manifestation of whom? Because they know other but Sachidanand, the divine. Therefore, the goal of creation, goal of all this is manifesting Sachidanand through individual body, mind and life. Meaning thereby Sat, the true substance, truth. Not falsehood, but truth which is the original truth. To discover the divine impulsion within me. That I must, not what society wants, people want, others want. No, the divine truth within me, Sat, Chit. To create mightily, powerfully, not helplessly. Forcefully even. And Ananda, which is the original bliss. This will be the sign. When one creates in a true way, this is the Ananda. This is the first wage given by the divine when we really are aligned with him. And to align more and more with the divine will and manifest it upon earth through our individual being, through everybody and in everybody who are connected with us and with each other through the whole earth. This is the goal and object of creation, so that this earth becomes divine, because in its origin it is divine. So that humanity leads a divine life collectively and individually, because its origin it is divine. So this is the goal, and world is marching towards it. Whether people want to, as I said, some want to withdraw, whether they think it's an easy option, let them try it, it's their business. Sit for meditation only for half an hour, truthfully, and you will know how easy or difficult it is. But let us not misread the intentions of the divine. You can't have two intentions. In the beginning, it cannot be an intention that I am throwing this ball so that it comes back to me, because there is no rebound there. The original intention is divine manifestation, and this is what we must stick to throughout in all our activities. And that can only be when we align ourselves with the divine will. This is the Jivan Mukta state. Between life of ignorance and the life of transformation to divine life, there is the state of Jivan Mukta, where inwardly we are free and we more and more are aligned to the divine will inwardly. Nature doesn't follow it because it's running by past momentum. So we keep putting the pressure till one day the entire nature is aligned to the divine will. So it is called as union with the divine. Union, it's one way to put it. This union is not a merger into oblivion. But union means our soul is always conscious, Brahma Bhut. It's ever living in the Lord. So it's one with the Lord. Our mind is completely united with the effulgence of the divine radiance. All that light is pouring into this mind. And that mind becomes the golden light came down into my mind. Maybe we'll close with that poem. Our heart becomes a vessel of the divine sweetness, love, delight. Our life becomes a luminous force, not a troubled, vexed, agitated, restless energy, turbulent energy. And even our body becomes true substance, sat, and not right now as it is, a substance which is mixed asat, which death can take away. So let's close with this wonderful poem. The ultimate goal of Sanatana Dharma, the golden light came down into my brain. The grey rooms of my mind sun-touched became. A bright reply from wisdom's occult plane, a calm illumination and a flame. Transformation of the mind. The golden light came down into my throat, and all my speech is now a song divine. This becomes Veda. All speech. It becomes Samaved. It is song divine. Gita. Why? Because the golden light has come and transformed. A paean song of thee, my single note. Countless things, but all of them are divine, divine, divine. A paean song of thee, my single note. My words are drunk with the infinite's wine. So the words carry that sweetness and delight. They are no more the dry, scholarly kind of thing, but the golden light came down into my heart, smiting my life with thy eternity. It's no more cabin into this, that, little corners. So what happens after that? The golden light came down into my heart, smiting my life with thy eternity. Now has it grown a temple where only thou art, and all its passions point towards only thee. 100 kinds of relation, but everywhere it is going towards that divine disclosure. But in the temple core, none else. Again and again, yesterday we were also reading, never let this space, the inmost heart, be occupied by anybody if one wants to do yoga. Natato namata, this tameva mata, chapita tameva. Nobody else can occupy that space. All there is another heart, outer heart. You'll have all kinds of relation, but you irradiate with this inmost heart. All relations should be irradiated from here, not a superficial thing, but from here. But this place is the Divine Mother's place. Even if somebody comes very close, the person has to be bowing down at her feet because she is at the center. No one else can. So, smiting my life with thy eternity. Now has it grown a temple. Look at it. This is the temple. Sanatana Dharma temple is where? First temple is universe. Second is atom. Or the two are together. And the third temple is man's body. Manavi manushi tanu ashritam. So now has it grown it. This is the temple we have to build. Now has it grown a temple where only the what? And all its passions point towards only thee. The golden light came down into my feet, and all my earth is now thy playfield and thy seat. Kridartha, Shurvinda says, this world is meant for the play of the Lord. Leela. Leelartha, Kridartha, not Pidartha. This is a mistranslation. Kridartha. Let's play with the Lord. And what a joy to play with him. He plays with, he wants to play with us. We have put him on a pedestal. and covered him with all kinds of, you know, incense sticks and malas and, you know, whatnot. And poor fellow, he can't even, you know, run away. 99% he runs away. Who will sit? Just try sitting one day, half a day. Okay, 1 hour. And let everybody come and start, you know, putting all these things around you with all the malas. And then, you know, put all kinds of incense near you. After some time, you'll say, spare me this Calvary. Nothing against it, do it with bhava. But don't flood him with all this, you know. People in ashram once wanted to break coconuts. And actually they broke. Somebody came with a coconut and broke near the samadhi. And then mother had to stop all this. Please don't do it. Literally breaking coconut. So she had to stop. Now, this is not about... There are much worse things in Semitism, but I am, because it's Sanatana Dharma, we must understand that true temple is here. And what is the incense we have to offer him? Mother writes so beautifully. The pure perfume of my aspiration rises towards thee, like the pure perfumes of the incense of India. This is the incense stick. Look at the flame, it's a little spark. But look how the whole dua is going up. This is the incense stick to be lit up. The flame to be lit up. The diya. What is that ghanti which you do? It is inside the call. And to hear the Lord's call. Actually the ghanta is the Lord's call. It's not your. It's the call of the Lord to hear his flute. And to respond to it as gopis and gopas did. That is what is building a temple within us. The Sankha Dhwani, the victory of the Lord. Can we proclaim that victory? I was reading, every day you do Sankha Dhwani, it has this frequency, corona will die. QED. Why are we becoming another materialist? It's okay, but look at the symbol. Sankha Dhwani, when is Sankha conch is blown in a battlefield? What does it mean when you do it during puja? May your victory be established upon my nature. When somebody asked, what is the mother's victory? Shrivinda said, it's the victory of the mother on each sadhak. That is the mother's victory. Be a victor over my ego. Namund Malini, take my head and make a mala of it. This is the real puja, the worship inside. Outer puja is important because many people don't understand the symbol. So you have to preserve it. So you have the bahya puja, you have the manas puja, and you have the ultimate where you don't need these two avalamb and you have the direct adhyan puja. But because in Indian thought, it was understood that not all are ready for that kind of. So they preserved it in the form of symbols, beautiful symbols. But it's not an end, it's an entry point. The entry point can't be an end. That now I have become a prosperity member, therefore now everything is over. It's the entry point. It is a great responsibility. Now I have turned to the divine, entered the temple. No, you have to walk all the way. Meenakshi Madurai temple, see how much you have to walk before you reach before the Lord and then divine mother and then, you know, bow down to her. So it was like, this is an entry. Now slowly you will see here, there, different things, all the gods. But you will not stop. You will reach when you are face to face with the Lord. Then you say, I am yours. So this is the whole vast, complex temple of Sanatana Dharma, which is built within man. This was the effort of the rishis to build this original temple within man, so that each of us can become a living example, not just an instrument and channel, but a living example of the divine. Seeing us, they may exclaim, people may explain, here is God. That's why we have the conception of the human guru. Because human beings can become one with God. It's not there in other religions, you see. There's only one. But here, there is the conception of human guru. The human magnet, vibhutis, gurus. Why? Because it's possible for human being to identify with the divine. And when you meet such a one, you can say, here is God. He is the door for you. You have not seen the divine. You don't know what is Parabrahma. But Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Sakshat Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Sri Guruve Nama. So he is the one in whom Parabrahma has become active, manifest. Otherwise he is beyond manifestation and non-manifestation. But in a living symbol, he becomes real, living, concrete. You can touch him, you can sense him. And through him you can receive what otherwise would take us millions of years. So that is the tradition of the Guru. We'll speak about it in our next class. Thank you. Namaste.